Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
In the 90s, New York detective Louis Scarcella locked up the worst criminals.
Putting bad guys away,
there's no feeling like it.
Then jailhouse lawyers took aim, led by Derek Hamilton.
Scarcella took me to the precinct and lied.
20 men eventually walked free. Now, in the Burden podcast, after a decade of silence, Louis Scarcella finally tells his story, and so does Derek Hamilton. Listen to The Burden on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Comedy Central.
From New York City, the only city in America, it's the show that invented news. This is The Daily Show with your host, Cal Penn.
Now listen, after last night's show, this is very sweet. I got so many encouraging words from some of my political colleagues, and I wanted to read some of them for you. This is an email I got from Speaker Nancy Pelosi. It says, Cal, if you don't donate $5 by tonight, we're all going to die. Thank you, Nancy. That was so touching. Anyway, we've got a great show for you tonight. Our guest tonight is the foreign minister of Pakistan. But first, let's get into the headlines. Okay, let's kick things off with a big announcement from President Joe Biden. You remember during the 2020 campaign, Biden said this.
By the way, no more drilling on federal lands, period. Period, period, period.
Period, period, period. Comma. Because now, Biden has approved a major oil drilling project on federal land in Alaska, which is disappointing. But hey, when you're that age, that's the only kind of drilling you can do. No, come on, I'm kidding. This guy f***. The crazy part about this drilling project is that they'll be installing a device called a thermosiphon that keeps the permafrost solid enough for drilling while it simultaneously melts due to global warming. Guess ConocoPhillips has an irony division? I mean, keeping the permafrost alive so they can kill it slowly, that's like some Silence of the Lambs serial killer shit. Would you f*** the planet? I'd f*** the planet. I worked at the White House. Now, thank you. Now listen. The good news is that Biden is also flip-flopping in a good way. Because back in the day, Biden used to think marijuana was a gateway drug. But now he's doing stuff like this.
President Biden is offering help to people who have a federal conviction for simple marijuana possession that can now apply for a presidential pardon. To qualify, applicants must have been charged or convicted in federal court or D.C. Superior Court before October 6th of last year.
This is huge! And this is long overdue, yeah! And look, heartfelt, this is a moment of special congrats to the advocates who have been pushing for this for so long. They really did it. Now, they convinced someone with 5 decades of experience in Washington to change his mind. That's not easy. That would be like convincing Mitch McConnell to let Democrats appoint judges or convincing Chuck Schumer that his glasses should be resting on the top of his nose. Top. In any case, if you're wondering what the Oval Office looks like now that Joe Biden is a total stoner, it probably looks something like this. It's the same. It's 2023. People who smoke weed don't put tapestries on their wall anymore. I mean, yeah, the portrait of George Washington does glow in black light now, but that's it. Mostly the same. Anyway, let's move on to some science news. Apparently, NASA is tracking an asteroid that could slam into Earth on Valentine's Day in 2046. Which means that friend of yours who always does those sad Valentine's Day posts like, I'm gonna die alone, actually is. Yeah. But if you're in a relationship, then in a way, it would kind of be beautiful to die on Valentine's Day, you know? Making sweet love with your partner one last time. Or if you're married, laying in bed, too full from dinner to have sex, watching Paul Blart one last time. Either way, super romantic. In other scientific news, researchers did a study on flamingos. And it turns out that flamingos form cliques, just like high schoolers. This is one of those studies where I feel like we need to know more about the scientist who did this study. Because maybe the flamingos just didn't want to hang out with them specifically. Seriously, though, this sounds terrible. It's tough enough being a flamingo. Now you also have to deal with flamingo mean girls? They must be so cruel. Do you see how short her neck is? Oh my God. It's giving emu. And look at her legs. They're like a whole centimeter thick. It's like paging Dr. Kankles. I heard she got a beak enhancement and the zookeeper paid for it. They're like totally right? Oh, wait. She's coming over here. Hi, Jenny. Oh my God, you know what? You look incredible. Okay, bye. Ugh, I literally hate her. And finally, thank you. Ridiculous. And finally, let's check in on my home state of New Jersey. I'm sure they're not doing anything incredibly stupid.
The city of Newark is admitting it got scammed. Earlier this year, Mayor Raj Baraka invited who he thought was the Hindu nation of Kailasa to City Hall for a cultural trade agreement and to become sister cities. But it turns out Kailasa isn't a real nation, but rather the invention of a scam artist and fugitive who's from India, who's been on the run since 2019.
I have the immunity of non-prosecutable and immunity and protection as the head of the state.
He was arrested there years earlier, accused of sexual assault charges by five women who say he abused them at a religious retreat. Back in New Jersey, a few days after this ceremony, the city says it realized it had been deceived, calling it, quote, a regrettable incident.
Jesus, Newark. How can an entire city get catfished? Not a single person realized they never heard of this country before? Not on a globe? Not at the Olympics? Not as a stage in Street Fighter? Look, if you can't find it as a cuisine on Grubhub, it's not a real country. There must have been so many red flags, the biggest one being that anyone wanted to be sister cities with Newark. Although, look, to be fair, just because a country was started by a sex criminal doesn't mean it's fake. Just ask Thomas Jefferson. For more on this, please give it up for Desi Leidick. Desi, what did you make of this story?
Well, Cal, as a white person, I would like to know what you think of this story. Because for me, I don't know, this is a little dicey. I don't want to upset anybody with any statements about whether Kailasa is a real country.
Okay, well, it's not. It's not a real country, it's a cult.
Right. But even so, I honor its culture and its rich traditions. Because what is culture if not cult? Sure.
Desi, come on, look how they're dressed. Does that look real to you?
Yes. No? No.
No. No. No. No. Come on. Those are just costumes.
Whoa, Cal, their culture is not a costume.
No. That is literally a costume. Desi, I understand what you're trying to do. You want to be an ally. I definitely appreciate that. But Kailasa does not deserve your allyship. Its leader is a sexual predator.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And I condemn all sexual predators. At the same time, it is important to support diversity among sexual predators.
No, it's not. Desi, stop. This is a cult, and they scammed the city of Newark.
Of course they did. Yes, they did. And they've been forced into cult behaviors by Western imperialism. And isn't that the real scam?
No. Well, yes. But no, wait, now you're confusing me. Hold on. There is no Western imperialism against Kailasa. There is no Kailasa. There are no Kailasians.
We say Kailasians X now.
No, we don't! Desi, look, I am giving you permission to criticize this fake country. On behalf of brown people, it's okay.
Oh, I'm not worried about brown people, Cal. I'm worried about other white people. If I disrespect this fake nation, they'll make my real Twitter a living hell. Does Kailasa look like a scammy cult? Yes. Do I trust white people on Twitter to know the difference? No. Which is why I am proud to announce that The Daily Show, hosted by Cal Penn, is now also a sister city with Kailasa.
What? No.
Yes.
Everyone. Next, I'll be taking you on a tour of my favorite sport. We'll be right back. Oh my gosh.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away. There's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive bonus content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Show. Look, a lot of people would be surprised to know that one of my favorite sports is NASCAR. Now, I know I don't look like your stereotypical NASCAR fan, but I also don't look like your stereotypical Abercrombie and Fitch homosexual. Yet here we are. So, what do I love about NASCAR? Take a look. Yeah, I know, you're looking at me and you're like, seriously, Cal, you've been a NASCAR fan for 12 years?
Yes, my fellow Blue State libs. Grab a beer and come with me. NASCAR has it all. Day drinking, grilling, whoever this guy is and whoever this guy is. Wait, is that Kid Rock?
This is so f***ing cool! And I can yell and never f***ing come out this
f***ing music! You get here on this track and you feel the rumble inside you when those cars are going around. I'm getting chills just thinking about it right now.
I felt the rumble in my dick.
Yeah, exactly.
I wasn't mad about it.
I'm not mad about it either, yes.
Okay, here's the deal. NASCAR is different from what you probably think.
I feel like people
people think it's just really like a redneck thing. And I mean, it kind of is, but it's for everyone, you know?
And I'm like, I've watched NASCAR since I was like 12 or before then because of my parents going to NASCAR races.
Black people love racing. People may not realize how much African Americans love not just NASCAR, any form of racing.
Bubba Wallace is one of the biggest stars in the sport, and he happens to agree.
I think, you know, from outside looking in, especially minorities, feel the stigma's been there that they're not welcome. And I've always been like, that's not really true. You know, I've been in NASCAR, this is my career has been 20 years. Yeah, 20 years is about
Aren't
right.
Aren't you like 29?
I'm 29,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, wow. I can tell you right now, there is no New Jersey parent who would let their kid drive at 9. So I always get the question, what's it like being an Indian American actor? I would imagine it also drives you insane to get the question, oh, what's it like being a black driver?
Yep.
So what's it like being a black driver?
Yeah, so clickbait and news outlets, they have to get their viewership up, and the way they do that is black driver.
Yeah,
I don't walk around saying I'm the black driver.
Yeah.
So yeah, you embrace it and you go out and enjoy what you do.
After I got my media clickbait, we moved on to an issue that everyday Americans actually care about.
All right, a lot of people really want to know this. How do you pee in 400 miles? I can't go 45 minutes without having
to
pull over.
So have you ever been in a high adrenaline moment?
Well, I once rode a cheetah in a movie.
Did you have to pee in that moment?
No.
Exactly.
So you're really in the zone then for that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And they always say, if you do pee in the car, then you got to be there Monday morning to clean it out. Do you want to clean it out?
You don't have somebody for that?
They're not going to do it. Ears.
Here's another stereotype. Drivers aren't real athletes. They just lazily sit there making left turns.
The athleticism side of it, to me, you know, our heart rates, you know, peak at about 170.
Okay.
And then during the race, you're around the 140 area. I mean, that's a high heart rate for a sustained long period of time.
Yeah.
And hydration is huge. I can lose up to about 7 pounds in the race car on a hot
in
day.
In one race?
Yes, sir.
Oh, can I drive this race? I would love to look, you know,
got good
a little...
physique, man. I mean,
thank you, thank
good.
You, thank you. I appreciate that.
And the drivers aren't the only jocks on the track. Meet Delonda Wendano, a former college athlete who trained as a tire changer after being recruited through NASCAR's diversity initiative.
Everybody knows how to change a tire. Well, I don't know how to change a tire, but what's the big deal about changing tires?
It's just about how fast you can do it. One tire can take, like, maybe 2-3 seconds. We did reps after reps after reps every time because I think 0.2 seconds cost a lot of money for a team if you make a mistake.
As someone who was recently told he had a good physique, I knew that joining the pit crew would be easy.
So like the jack man's jacking the car up, I'm like, jack that shit up. He jacks it up, the guy's giving him some gas. I grab the other tire because I gotta take it out, and I bring it back like this, and I kick it over there, and then everyone's like, you're almost gonna win. So I grab it like that, and I bring it back over here, and I'm like, okay, great job, and the driver takes off. So he wins the race, and we win a lot of money.
Yeah, in theory. I think we missed a couple steps.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, and that's a penalty.
After crushing it with the pit crew, I wanted to see if there were any indoor jobs with air conditioning.
There's just so much more data and science that goes into it than I think anybody really realizes when they see cars going around in circles, right? So data comes from the cars, and then the car has its speed, it's got its RPM and the gear that it's in. That's like, is the car loose, like wants to spin out, or is it tight? We look at what the driver is doing with the wheel, and then we try and tell him, hey, you need to turn the wheel less, or you need to be on the gas more.
This sounds like cheating. Tom Brady fans would love this.
Absolutely.
As a number-crunching genius, JR represents the new NASCAR and has had a front-row seat to the sport's evolution.
The sport's way different than it has been in the past. You know, my husband and I talk about it all the time, even myself working for Bubba. You know, I think a lot of people have always thought that this sport was kind of out of reach, not only because of they couldn't get into the sport, but also because they wouldn't be accepted by the sport. I mean, I think that just being out there and being vocal is super important, and I never thought 12-year-old me would be doing it.
Well, this was 12-year-old me, and he would have been terrified by what I'm about to do.
Where do I connect the Bluetooth for the podcast?
Oh, I wish. These things are meant for it to go fast, so anything extra, we just pull out of the car.
Okay. I can't drive stick. Is that a problem?
No, you're good.
Okay.
We basically just put you in fourth gear, just push you off, man.
Do only the snowflake drivers get the push since we can't drive stick?
Pretty much.
Here we go.
This is real inclusion. NASCAR making space for athletes like me who can't drive stick.
I'm clutch, give me gas, I'm clutch, give me gas, I'm clutch, give me gas, give me gas.
That left pedal, push it in, grab that stick and put it all the way down to the right. One stick. the shifter. It's that big stick in the middle right there of that car.
Okay, you're saying pull it, push it forward.
There you go. You're doing good out there.
All good. This is awesome. Oh, I can feel my face. Woo!
A little scared at first, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then I was like getting into it. And then after I peed my pants, it was such a relief. That was f***ing awesome!
Okay, that was fun, and I lost 2 pounds. But there is a more social way to enjoy racing.
Hey, guys! Can I come up?
Yeah!
Yes! Thank you!
This is the infield, where families camp out for the weekend to watch the races up close.
Are you thirsty?
Sure.
There you go. Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers. Thank you, guys. How long have you been coming here?
For 23 years. We're all family.
You definitely have the best view.
And that's really what NASCAR is all about. Family, speed, and crushing beers on top of an RV with a group of new friends.
Cheers.
All right, stay tuned, because when we come back, the Foreign Minister of Pakistan will be joining me, so don't go away.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarsella.
Putting bad guys away. There's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarsella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case. Scarsella. We got to show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive bonus content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
To the Daily Show. My guest tonight is the Foreign Minister of Pakistan. Please welcome Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. How are you? Good to see you, Malala. Have a seat, have a seat. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, thanks for being here. Now, for folks who don't know, your mom was former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, who was assassinated in 2007. But now you are the youngest foreign minister in Pakistan's history. You're 34.
That's true. Yeah.
And you're a very young country. I think the median age in Pakistan is only 20, something like that, roughly 20.
Yeah, 60% of our population are beneath the age of 35.
Wow. So how does your age create an opportunity for leadership in a country that's so young?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think that most of, if you look at the politics in Pakistan, or the political landscape, it's one or two generations above me that are the main players. Yeah. So I'm sure that given that I am so young, I'll bring a unique perspective. And I think that's so important because everybody who's in power right now or in positions of influence and making decision for our country, they'll live for 10, 20 years. Yeah. We have to think about sort of the long picture and how climate change and poverty and all the income and inequality and discrimination that people are facing across the country, how are we going to address those issues in the long term?
Do you feel like there's ever a generational divide
between the people who you
I think absolutely. I think it's been an experience working with people from a whole host of different age groups. And absolutely, I felt across sort of throughout my political career, just as a result of my age, perhaps the same ideas, same suggestions given from other people of a more senior age would be taken more seriously, as opposed to coming from a younger perspective. But at the same time, I think I'd like to say I've proven over the course of time, whether I was in opposition or as foreign minister, that age is just a number, and we can still get quite a lot done.
So it's timely having you here tonight.
Yeah, topical.
Right now, you know, Pakistan is facing some unrest over the imminent arrest of former Prime Minister Imran Khan. Mr. Khan says that your government wants him arrested so that he's disqualified from upcoming elections. Is that true?
Okay, so unfortunately, Pakistan is facing a perfect storm. Not only do we have heightened partisanship and political polarization to the extent that political parties or political stakeholders aren't even in a position to sit in a room and discuss issues amongst themselves, we're also facing an economic crisis. We're facing a security threat and security crisis, and the fallout from the fall of the Afghan government and the increase in the terrorist attacks that are taking place with increasing frequency in Pakistan. We just faced the biggest climate catastrophe of our history, where a third of the landmass of our country was underwater. That's something that my generation, generations to come, are going to be paying the price for the decisions that others have taken. And unfortunately, in all this chaos, and in all these, while we're facing these simultaneous crises, we have the question of Mr. Khan, who believes that the Pakistani constitution doesn't apply to him, the Pakistani law doesn't apply to him, that he can get up and leave, he's resigned from parliament and run away from the system. In this particular instance, it's not a question of me wanting to arrest Mr. Khan. I come from a family who faced genuine arrest in the face of military dictatorships. My mom, my mother, when she was younger than me, she battled an Islamist dictator at the time who threw her in prison. My father spent 11 and a half years in prison and was tortured without a conviction. I would never want any politician in my country or any country to go to jail for political reasons. In Mr. Khan's case, he's under the threat of arrest because of his ego. He says that the courts are saying that he has to come to court and fight his cases, whatever cases are against them. And he says, I'm Imran Khan and I'm too important and I'm not going to turn up to court. And what we've seen over the last couple of weeks has been a complete mockery of the judicial system in Pakistan, of rule of law, of the constitution in Pakistan, where had he gone to court, there's probably no reason he had to fear imminent arrest. Because he's violated court orders time and time again, finally the courts have instructed the police to produce him before court, but he's called on his citizens, on his workers, on his supporters to come and confront the police. The police went to him with no intention of violence, and as you may be aware, Pakistan's history is full of politicians who have gone to prison, right, wrong, or otherwise. In this case, Mr. Khan is refusing to even present himself before court. He's refusing to defend himself. I'm sure if he's innocent, he'll be able to clear his name through the judicial system. So we're caught in a situation where there's this political chaos playing out on the streets and distracting from the real issues that are affecting everyday Pakistanis.
What does that say about the state of democracy in Pakistan? Is it fragile right now?
No, absolutely. Pakistan has been most of our history under direct military dictatorship. After the assassination of my mother, there was a brief period of democratic transition. Political parties came together. They reached a consensus that, we removed all the dictator's laws from the constitution, devolved power to parliament, had peaceful transfer of power for the first time in our history from one government to another. And those people or those forces that benefit from undemocratic rule in Pakistan didn't like that, so they supported Mr. Khan and brought him into power, and that's now blown up not only in those individuals' face but has had severe consequences for our country.
You talked about your own family, and so I just wanted to expand on that because I think for an American audience especially, you see a lot of politicians, not just in Pakistan, but obviously many countries, regardless of political party, who are accused of corruption, accused of other charges, in and out of prison, or violence. How do you know whether someone has committed a credible violation of law or whether something is politically motivated. What's the litmus there, and how do your voters, not just from your party, but overall in Pakistan, how do they respond to that, and how do you take that temperature?
So that is something that I've lived with my entire life, because my mother was Prime Minister of Pakistan for a few years, but she spent most of her life in opposition, either in country, in prison, or in exile, fighting not one, but two military dictatorships. She spent the 30 years of her life fighting politically motivated cases where the perception was built in the media and otherwise, this corruption and a whole host of allegations. After she was assassinated, her name has been cleared from each and every single case that was lodged against her in her lifetime. And I, as her son and who's someone who lived through that, really wish that it happened while she was still here and amongst us. Unfortunately, that was the tradition of Pakistani politics. After my mother's assassination, the big political parties in Pakistan came together and they said, look, if we're going to be fighting amongst ourselves all the time and taking our political differences as personal differences, and whoever's in power, they arrest the opposition, then we're never going to get anything done as a country. And we saw a gap of 10 years where we didn't go after each other, with two different political parties came into power. They served out their term, were voted out from the people, and the next political party came into place. Mr. Khan is the one who unfortunately broke those precedences.
So you're talking about essentially what sounds like a fragile democracy.
Extremely
and things that are malleable and moving back and forth. To what extent does that impact economics in Pakistan? I know that right now the IMF and you are, sort of at odds, and I know that they're withholding some money until tax reforms are met. I believe that was, correct me if I'm wrong, that was negotiated by a previous government, but now you're in power,
so
you're
dealing the consequences.
Your party needs to follow up on on what was negotiated. So how does that political instability then affect
economics? So two things. As far as how democratic are we right now, I would say we're in a democratic transition, mm-hmm. and I hope that this goes well and we transition towards a more democratic society, because I believe that Pakistan is facing a whole host of problems, but no matter the problem, the answer is in more democracy. But I might be wrong, and it could go the other way. As far as our economic situation is concerned, as I mentioned, we're in the perfect storm. You're absolutely right. The deal with the IMF was made by the previous government, and the previous government violated that deal with the IMF that put Pakistan in an extremely precarious economic situation. We've also, like the rest of the world, feeling the economic impacts of the war in Ukraine, of the COVID pandemic, and at the same time, as a result from the fall of Kabul a year ago, we've seen the return to terrorism in our country, an increase in terrorist activity that has its own impact on economics, and the climate catastrophe. The floods that took out 5 million acres of standing crops, 1 in 7 Pakistanis, that's 33 million people, were affected. Many people are still affected.
I wanted to ask you about that.
All of these things coming together put our economy under incredible strain and stress. And you're absolutely right. Our negotiations are still ongoing and have not been concluded with the IMF. And I'm actually left of center political party who, within our own politics, calls for an increase in tax revenue, addressing the income inequalities, mm-hmm. Etc. But at this point of time, I think that when Pakistan is facing such a perfect storm, some problems of our own creation, but some like the flood and others that are not of our own, that the conversation with the IMF really should take that into account. And mm-hmm. I don't think it is at the moment.
But in terms of how the tax structure works in Pakistan, I don't want to get too in the weeds on tax structure. I know that's not your job. But one of the things that I was reminded of when I was prepping for our conversation, I know that you're from a relatively wealthy landowning family, and there are many in Pakistan. Do you know who Bernie Sanders is?
Yes, I do.
Okay,
so I know who Bernie is.
So Bernie, Bernie's a big fan of making sure the 1% pay their
absolutely,
fair share and all that
absolutely.
Big topic here. Is there a version of that in Pakistan? Can the wealthiest families do something to sort of help?
So I think that's so interesting that you answer that question. From the mainstream political parties in Pakistan, with the Pakistan People's Party, and we are the left of center political party. Today, we're a left of center political party. When we started out, we were actually a socialist a political party. Okay. And my grandfather was heading the party at the time, became the country's prime minister, and that's exactly what he did. He rebelled against his own class because he was a rich, wealthy landlord that owned masses of land. But he led land reforms, which took away vast amounts of lands for the wealthy and redistributed it amongst the landless people of the area. He read industrial reforms where 22 families in Pakistan had like a death grip on our economy and they own all the industry in our country. So then he nationalized the industry so that it worked for the many and not for the few, Mala Burney. At the moment, unfortunately, where we are in Pakistan is very far away from the vision that the founders of my party laid out or the efforts that my mother did as far as addressing the gap between the rich and poor. And what we have is a system where the elites like myself can weather these storms without much pain or without feeling much difference. But whether it is our deals with the IMF or our own internal economic policy, there's an outside burden on the poorest of the poor. There's an outside burden, a burden on the bottom of the pyramid. And what we'd like to see, I believe the only way for us to have a functioning economy that works for everyone would be not only for everyone to pay their fair share as far as taxation is concerned, but we do need a fundamental reform about how we talk about our economy and what decisions we take domestically in order to achieve that.
I know that last year you did a lot of work raising awareness on the fact that a third of your country was underwater from those devastating floods. That's obviously faded from international news since then. Can you give us an update on the status of the people affected?
No, thank you so much for asking. We're a country that has experienced floods and monsoons consistently. This was something apocalyptic out of sort of, you know, a la Noah's Ark floods scale. Mm-hmm. I've never seen anything like it. And we're still battling with the consequences. I absolutely have been raising awareness. I'm very grateful that the international community stood with Pakistan on not one but two occasions. One at the COP, where Pakistan was the chair of the developing countries group of G77, and we helped push for loss and damage to be included on a COP's agenda, which I think is a big achievement as far as the climate movement is concerned and the future of developing countries. And the second is when we had held a resilient, climate resilient Pakistan conference in Geneva, where the international community stood with us and pledged some money for reconstruction. As far as attention is concerned, of course, international media attention span is very small, and that has moved on. But the sad thing is that domestic attention has moved on. I come from the province of Sindh, which was the most devastated. Two-thirds of our province was underwater as a result of this flood. The political conversation has moved on. We're talking about whether Imran Khan's going to get arrested or not. And we're not talking about the millions of people who are at the moment in danger of, you know, I don't like to throw about words like famine, but there's a food scarcity issue for them. The people that are thrown into poverty. I mean, there's this impression, right, it's a completely impoverished people that had no hope and they're still poor. I mean, it's awful that anybody get affected by floods, but I just want to emphasize that of these people, 33 million people that were affected, some of these people, I mean, they're not living the most elitist lives or the most well-off lives, but they were getting by. They had their little shop. They had their little bit of land that they were eking a living out of. And they've been thrown into poverty. And it's going to take us a while to claw back from that. And until we do so, unfortunately, I wish I could stand here and say that my country was paying the attention that it should to this issue. But unfortunately, I'm afraid to admit we're being distracted.
I want to ask you about solutions also. You mentioned loss and damage. Is that what you said?
Loss and damage at COP, okay. Absolutely.
Can you talk about what that is? And then also, what are sort of the plans on addressing climate longer term for Pakistan?
Okay, so there are two arguments around the loss and damage debate at COP. Yeah. And the sort of the more basic, sort of more activist approach to that conversation is that rich countries, industrialized countries, have created this crisis, and they're a whole host of countries.
This climate crisis.
The climate crisis, and as a result of it's their industrialization, right? It's the rich world's industrialization that the poor world is paying the cost of in the form of massive floods or massive droughts, and there should be some loss of damage for this. Some people advocate for reparations. Mm-hmm. I'm actually not one of those people.
Okay.
I like to be sort of, you know, left in our approach to politics and things, but I also like to get things done.
I mean, reparations-wise, I feel like India, Pakistan, and the U.S. could get some shit from the U.K.
That's exactly what I mean, right? So we haven't got any post-colonial reparations, and slavery reparations, the conversation hasn't gone anywhere. I mean, fair enough, the activists who want to argue for that should, and it's a legitimate point to make. But I think a practical approach is for us to say, okay, loss and damage exists. Let's decide who's going to pay for it later, but actually it's a problem that we all have to address together. And international financial institutions are just not equipped to deal with even one climate tragedy to the scale of what we faced. Now, the unfortunate thing is not just one country. We have historic floods in Pakistan, so we have historic droughts in China, and at the same time, you've got forest fires here in California, or it's flooding. Mm-hmm. And so we need to rework international financial institutions, rather than looking at this as reparations, how are we going to work together to come up with the money to address loss and damage as a result of climate change? The fight to put loss and damage onto the agenda is a 30-year-old fight. At the last COP, it was achieved under the chairmanship of Egypt that it's now going to be on the agenda. Okay. It's going to take a while for this to be argued out and the international community to come to a decision. It's an important achievement. But rather than, I don't want us to pit the global north against the global south and try and find solutions to climate change like that. I believe that this is a problem too big for just America to deal with on their own or just China to deal with on their own. This is something that the world has to come together and decide, are we going to be distracted by war and conflict and politics as usual, or are we going to find a solution to this problem? And I have just and I can say that, I've just experienced this from the Pakistani perspective, from this one flood that wiped out so much and caused so much devastation, that we're not equipped for that. I see how, whether it's domestic politics or geopolitics, get in the way of things we even can do now. So I hope that, I mean, I know that your president has done a lot of stuff domestically on climate, and I really hope that that sort of approach, that sort of mentality is translated out into the world stage and we can work together to sort this out. Otherwise, Pakistan is, we've contributed less than 0.1% to the global carbon footprint, but we are amongst the 10 most climate stressed countries on the planet. Did you know that there's a third pole? There's a North Pole and a South Pole that we all knew about and we're worried about it's melting. The third pole is in Pakistan, in the Himalayan regions of our country.
Is this real or is this a conspiracy theory thing?
The third pole is technically in Pakistan, with the largest number of glaciers on the peaks of the mountain ranges between our two countries. And I'm, as a result of climate change, obviously the North and South Pole are going to be melting, but this third pole is going to be melting. Our rivers are fed by these glaciers. So what that means is, in the short term, as these, as this pole melts, as these glaciers melt, we will be faced by floods. The flood that we just experienced, by the way, not a riverine flood, a flood that came from the skies. We're predicted to face far more greater flooding from the rivers as these glaciers melt. Once these glaciers melt, our water source is done. We won't be able to provide drinking water to the people that live in my country. This is one country's problem when it comes to climate change. There are a whole host of other countries that are facing, for them and for us, the crisis is here and now. This is not a tomorrow issue.
For all of these issues, is there capacity to take action both in the short or long term for you, or is that something that is being worked out? And I'm asking that also in the context of, you are clearly very passionate about this issue. This almost goes back to my first question about you being a young leader in Pakistan. I would imagine you feel this issue a lot more than others might.
So there are two things. First of all, I'm very proud of the fact that my mother's last manifesto in 2007, before she was assassinated, she was the first Pakistani politician to have climate on her agenda. And I often think that had we started addressing things then, in 2007, 2008, 2009, maybe we wouldn't be here today. But despite all of that, I was not the most hyper of climate activists. Like, okay, I got it. We'll do some wind, we'll do some solar, and hopefully things will be fine. My worldview changed overnight when my home, the villages around it, the people that I know, it was suddenly just water as far as the eye could see. And now, yeah, frankly, I go Greta. I'm completely, we've been forced from, until it doesn't happen to you, you don't really know what's coming. And now that it's happened to us, the thought that this could happen regularly, it devastated me, because I've never felt so disempowered in that moment. Mm. What do you do when overnight 33 million people need your help, but you don't have the tents, you don't have the rations, we're usually used to drought, we don't have boats, how do we get out to these? It was the most difficult period in my public life, and it's not on the agenda, it's not in the media conversation, but on the ground, we're feeling this like severely.
Well, this is why I wanted to ask you about it. I thought it was important.
Thanks, Mark.
Work that you're doing. The Taliban is back in power in Afghanistan. I think my biggest curiosity, since they are the government in Afghanistan, they're your neighbor, what's it like negotiating with them? What's it like when you have to?
So that's an interesting question. Okay, so the Taliban in Afghanistan are now in the interim government there. And that is a result of the Doha deal process that they negotiated directly with the United States. We being their neighbor, even though like the rest of the world, we haven't recognized them diplomatically, et cetera, are forced to engage with the reality on our border. Mm-hmm. We can't afford to sort of wash our hands and turn our backs and pretend that nothing has changed. And we are advocating not only for ourselves, but for the international community to also engage with them. I believe that we were off to a positive start initially, but given what's happened with women's education and their right to access education, it's becoming incredibly difficult for me or others like me who do want to engage with them, do want to find solutions to the problems the people of Afghanistan are facing. Because they're taking these decisions that, at the very least, I mean, to say it the most diplomatically than I can, I mean, it's not helping us help them. And our consistent concern is that whatever happens in Afghanistan, Pakistan is going to be the first people to feel the consequences. There's this old saying that if Kabul sneezes, Islamabad catches a cold. And we're already seeing that. We have the United Nations says that 97% of the population in Afghanistan are falling beneath the poverty line. That means that the number of refugees and their exodus is going to be affected. Pakistan has already accepted millions of refugees in the past, but hundreds of thousands of refugees have come over since the fall of Kabul. The more the economic situation deteriorates in Afghanistan, the more cannon fodder the terrorist groups over there are going to have, the more people they're going to be able to recruit to their cause. And we have seen, since the fall of Kabul, a steady uptick of terrorist activity in Pakistan. If there's a regime that says that girls can't get education in Afghanistan, it's not going to be too long till politicians are going to start popping up in my neck of the woods saying that we should also not let girls have access to education. So I think, A, it's incredibly important to engage with them. But at the same time, my request to them and through your TV show to them would be, like, let girls learn, guys.
The contrast that you just set up is certainly pronounced, and most Americans, I think, still associate Pakistan with harboring bin Laden, with issues of terror. How do we move beyond that in terms of U.S.-Pakistan relations? What's next?
Look, how do we move beyond that? I think that whatever happened during the sort of the war on terror and the entire period that followed, there's a fog of war. And that colors everyone's decision-making, everyone's perception. What we have now is a reality in Afghanistan, a reality that has very serious consequences, first for Pakistan, but all the issues I mentioned. whether it's refugees or terrorism. It's Pakistan's problem today. Tomorrow it'll be other countries' problem. We have to get serious about engaging on the topic of Afghanistan. I believe that based on the facts on the ground, the position and perspective of Pakistan and the United States, actually, we meet eye to eye. We see things quite similar. I mean, we're basically on the same page. And whatever has happened in the past, we should be able to have honest conversations about that. And there can be many studies and analysis about what went wrong where. But it's also time for us to get working together on what we're going to do about the future. What are we going to do about the present day? And that's what I've been working on with my counterpart, Secretary Blinken.
I have one last question for you. You know, I know regardless of your political party or your political opposition, clearly you are the youngest person to serve in this role. What's your message to other young people who feel called to serve?
Oh, never give up and give it your best shot. I can't tell you the amount of times, for example, when we removed Mr. Khan from his prime ministership, it was the first time in Pakistan's history that a dictator didn't come in and kick out a prime minister, that a judge didn't order the removal of a prime minister, but for the first time, our parliament voted them out. And that idea, that proposition came from me. But it took me 2 years to convince everybody else, because no one believed that it would happen. And ultimately, it did. So the one thing that I've learned from what I'm doing, that it's difficult and it's tough and all those other things. But the more young people we have who get to look at things for the long term and not just sort of the imminent future, the short term solution, but actually have to live with the consequences of their decisions, the better decisions we can make.
Thank you for joining us. And thank you for your candor. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Harris. I appreciate it. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Really detailed, the climate stuff.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarsella.
Putting bad guys away. There's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarsella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the lawyer was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarsella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They could go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive bonus content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's our show for tonight, but before we go, please consider supporting South Asian Youth Action. They provide accessible, safe, and culturally affirming year-round programming to New York City students. If you can support them in their work, please donate at the link below.
Explore more shows from the Daily Show podcast universe by searching The Daily Show, wherever you get your podcasts. Watch The Daily Show weeknights at 11, 10 Central on Comedy Central, and stream full episodes anytime on Paramount Plus.
This has been a Comedy Central podcast.
In the 90s, New York detective Louis Scarsella locked up the worst criminals.
Putting bad guys away. There's no feeling like it.
Then jailhouse lawyers took aim, led by Derek Hamilton.
Scarsella took me to the precinct and lied.
20 men eventually walked free. Now, In the Burden podcast, after a decade of silence, Louis Scarsella finally tells his story, and so does Derek Hamilton. Listen to The Burden on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.